It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's a fine Independence Day week, and Kevin McKinley is with us to talk about financial independence. Kevin, of course, joins us every Tuesday to talk about finance. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And he joins us this morning from WPR Studio in Eau Claire. What is your personal finance question? How are you doing on the road to financial independence? Do you despair that you will ever get there? Do you have a goal you're working toward? Is this your dream retirement that you are in, or could it be better? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, today we are going to devote the entire show to financial planning for independence.
Seems like the right thing to do, Carrie. With Independence Day this week, we're going to discuss our most requested topic and the facts and figures that people ask for most over these many years. talking about how much money you need, how to check your progress, how to get there sooner, how to reach financial independence sooner, and then once you're there, how to stay there.
Okay, so talk to me about what you need. How do you define financial independence?
Yeah, most people, when you use the word financial independence, they think rich. And according to the Modern Wealth Index survey conducted by Charles Schwab every single year, the median amount at which people say you are rich is, excuse me, $1.4 million. But when pressed on that issue, they said, well, wait a minute. Now, just draw back a little bit. When you talk about rich and being independent, what does that really mean to you? And what people then said, their most common answers from number five to number one backwards is to number five is to have lots of money. Number four is to enjoy life. Number three is having loving relationships with their family and friends and the time to have those relationships. Number two is to afford anything and everything they need. And number one, the most common cited answer when people said, what do you mean about being financially independent? They said no stress. And so I like to think of that as just saying you can stop stressing out about money. And I'll tell you, I work with a lot of people who have reached these lofty figures in wealth. They still get kind of stressed out about money. But this is more about retiring when you want. And if you are going to work, working where you want to work, but not for the money. You might be working fewer hours, or maybe you're working at a job that pays less but offers you more satisfaction and flexibility.
So we're talking about financial independence on today's On Your Money. Retirees, let us know, what did you do to set yourself up for retirement? Was it enough? What would you do differently if you had the chance? 1-800-642-1234. We're going to give you a different email, onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, how are Americans doing generally in terms of reaching financial independence?
Most of us have a little bit of work to do. The median net worth right now, according to the Federal Reserve, and it generally does go according to age. If you're a younger adult, and by younger, you know, even the median age in America right now is 35, and so half of Americans are younger than 35, and those people, their household median net worth, this means half have more than this and half have less, is $11,000, and that includes household equity. So if you feel broke and you're 35 and under, you're okay. But 35 to 44 is still just $60,000 of total net worth. 45 to 54 is $125,000. And 55 to 64 is $185,000 of median net worth. And again, including home equity. Now, savings for retirement, we're doing a little better than that. The average balance, but now again, this is average, not median. So this is all retirement savings together divided by individual adults, is about $100,000. But because so many younger adults are still struggling with student loans, with rising housing costs, they have more health insurance out-of-pocket costs that they're paying as well. Inflation right now is at 2.8%. That's the highest in 6 years. And wages have generally been flat. We've just seen an increase of 2.7% in wages. That's the biggest in 11 years. So costs have risen faster than wages over the last several years. And the price of wants, like iPhones and data plans and Netflix, are falling. But the prices of needs, like shelter, education, healthcare, food, those are all rising, which makes it very difficult for a lot of people to put any money aside at all.
I think a lot of people would say that having a communications device is more of a need than a want. But also, I want to address 2008, a lot of people lost money. How are they doing?
Generally, they're getting much better, especially because if they stay invested and were able to reinvest over the last 10 years or so, obviously the stock market has gone up, in the Dow Jones perspective anyway, just about 350% or so over the last 10 years. But that's for people who not only had money to save, but were willing to take the risk that the next crash or crunch or correction or whatever you want to call it could happen again.
So give us a hint as to what people need to know to become financially independent.
A lot of people think it's how much I have or how much I have invested, where it's invested, how much I earn. And I can tell you from 30 years of doing this as a financial planner and literally looking at thousands of different individual financial situations, it has nothing to do with that and way more to do with how much you spend, which is good news because to a great degree, you can control what you spend. You can't control the stock market or what you earn to a great degree. You can't just walk into your boss's office and demand more money and expect to get it, but you can cut your spending by a decent amount. So the less you spend, the less you need to be financially independent, and then the more you can save, and the more that you can spend once you do actually retire.
And spending can include things like daily spending. It also could include maybe get a smaller house.
Exactly. We'll talk about that a little later.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through his broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to any investment decisions. We are taking your calls this morning with On Your Money, 800-642-1234. Talking about financial independence, you can email On Your Money at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We do have a few calls here already. You're a popular guy, Kevin. People call immediately. Chris from Appleton, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm 28 years old, college graduate, with about $40,000 left of student loans. And I have bit of a career snafu, and I reached for a credit card, and I shouldn't have done that because now I have $15,000 in credit card debt that I've never been able to gain a foothold on. I have some medical bills, and I have a child on the way, and I would like to get out from renting, but all of these things are overwhelming. Some people recently have been pushing me to look into bankruptcy, but I don't know if that is a correct or prudent option for me in my situation.
Okay, Chris, thank you for that. Bankruptcy, Kevin?
Well, that's a usually a last resort situation where that should be considered, but it still is an option. There's a reason for it. The reason being is that America's economic growth over the last 50 or 100 years would not be nearly as meteoric if there weren't an option for people who either just made a mistake or had bad things happen to them to get out from under that debt and not go to debtor's prison. I mean, it's part of the reason why we pay 15% on average on credit card interest rates is because a lot of people, a small portion, but it's still the numbers in the hundreds of thousands every single year, charge up credit cards and then they can't pay it off for whatever reason. And so bankruptcy is an option for Chris and other people out there who are struggling with it. But what I'd prefer instead is that they talk to a credit counselor. You can go to debtadvice.org and you'll be sent to a listing that'll give you credit counselors you can talk to over the phone. They're usually free or low cost, and they're certified credit counselors, meaning they don't try to take a bunch of money up front and then offer nothing for it. And the tough part about Chris's situation is that student loans generally are difficult to discharge during bankruptcy. It's part of the reason why the interest rates are low is because they're harder to get out of if you run into financial problems. And so I definitely would suggest, Chris, that you talk to the credit counselor now, talk to the lenders as well, and say, here's my situation. Explain what you just did to me and say, I've run into problems. I can't make these payments. What are my options? And don't just take their options, but you won't be the first person who's called today with those problems, even if you call it, 901 Central Standard Time. That's all they do is take calls from people who say, I can't make my payment. And it's much better to be proactive in this situation rather than just wait for the bills to keep piling up, which would be a natural reaction to it, is to just say, I can't deal with this right now. I have so much stress for it. And people have, less smart than you, Chris, have gotten out of much bigger holes than this. So your willingness to call in and say, hey, I have these issues. I'm trying to deal with them. It's not the end of the world. It's not death. It's not cancer. It's something that many people have. There are certain presidents who have declared bankruptcy on their businesses and said, I need to reorganize my situation. I'll try to pay off everybody I can. But it's there for a reason. I don't think it should be your first option, but it definitely is something that you want to consider. And then again, call the lenders and try to see if there's some way that you can work with them to either lower your current payment so you can start to get ahead of yourself, or if there's a chance that they would be willing to negotiate a smaller debt rate down, especially if you can make a lump sum payment for it. But again, go to debtadvice.org, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Chris, thank you for that. And yes, Kevin, there are presidents who have declared bankruptcy multiple times even. You said you can help people figure out how much they need to become financially independent based on only one factor. What's that factor?
That factor is when people send their information and say to me, say, Kevin, I'd like to work with you as a financial advisor, that we have a questionnaire we send out. And the first thing that I look at, it's not what they earn. It's not how much they have. It's how much they spend every single month, because that only not only tells me kind of where they're at right now, but it's going to tell me how much they need to be financially independent. And it also gives me an insight to kind of where their head is at and what kind of lifestyle they've either adopted or have thrust upon them for it. It does vary, but in the United States, most American households spend somewhere around $5,000 per month. And again, that can vary a lot from one region to another.
So there are some people who don't make $5,000. Are they spending more than they're making?
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. It usually can't go on for very long, obviously. So sooner or later, things have to break for it. They get so much into debt that then just the interest payments or minimum payments alone exceed what they could cover for it.
So how do you use that figure to determine when we can retire?
All right. This is our favorite calculation here, as we talked about last week, the free bird of our repertoire. What you do is you take that amount, the amount that you spend in a typical month, and or what you plan to spend on when you retire, and then you subtract any Social Security or pension that you expect to receive in retirement and multiply the net figure by 250. And that's kind of a minimum figure. And that sum is the lump sum that you need to retire comfortably in the future.
So how do we know how much Social Security and pension, how do we know how much our checks are going to be 30 years into the future?
Most people who do provide the pension and Social Security try to make some kind of projection and say, if your earnings continue with us as they do, here's how much you'll probably make. For Social Security, we have a pretty good idea that full-time workers, most of them will probably receive somewhere around $2,000 per month if they've worked the majority of their adult years. The average check right now is somewhere around, I think, $1,300 or $1,400 per month, but that reflects the fact that a lot of those checks are going to people who were stay-at-home parents and are claiming just spousal benefits, not actual worker benefits.
Interesting. So if we take this and we multiply it by 250, give us an example with real numbers.
Okay, so let's say you are one of those average Americans who's spending $5,000 per month now, and you think that's what you're going to spend when you retire. And then let's say you're fortunate enough that you're going to have $3,000 a month coming in the form of Social Security, whether it's one of you or two of you, or there's a pension check coming in. You subtract the $3,000 from the $5,000 amount, and that will leave you with a $2,000 amount per month that you need to cover from your savings. And if you multiply that by 250, that's $500,000 you would need to say, yes, I'm I'm going to retire. I'm going to retire comfortably, and I'm going to consider myself financially independent.
And just a little while ago, you said that most people have about $100,000 in the bank, pretty much that.
For retirement.
It. Yes.
That's right. But that's every adult. That's the average dollar amount. And that does reflect the fact that there's lots of $1 million accounts out there, but there are also lots of $1,000 accounts out there.
We have been talking to Kevin McKinley about financial independence on Your Money this week. We'll be back with Kevin in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Kevin McKinley is at the WPR studio in Eau Claire. He's taking us through how we might become financially independent this Independence Day week. That's tough if you lost your savings in the financial crash a decade ago, or if you aren't able to really start saving because of high student loans and perhaps a delay in getting a job. How are you doing on the path to financial independence? Give us a call. 800-642-1234, On Your Money at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Morning. So, Kevin, we're in the middle of this calculation here. We determined that you need about $500,000 in retirement, and most people don't have that. So how can our younger listeners figure out if they're on the right track?
Yeah, I just want to be clear for people out there. You really don't need necessarily $500,000. Okay. You may need more, but you may need less, and it's dependent upon your spending. And the calculation that we'd used, you're spending $5,000 per month now, and you plan to spend that when you retire. You're expecting $3,000 in Social Security or pension. And take that net amount, which is $2,000, and multiply whatever that figure is by 250. And that's how we arrived at the $500,000. But a lot of people, as you mentioned, aren't quite there yet. So here's a way that you can figure out if you're on track, depending upon your age. So if you're figuring out how much you're spending per month, you've figured out how much you're getting Social Security and pension. You're not 65 yet, or you're not nearing retirement age. So to use that same factor, that net dollar amount that you get out, you should have about 10 times that amount saved up in your 20s. So if it's $2,000, you should try to have $40,000 saved for retirement. Mm-hmm. In your 30s, you should try to have 25 times the net amount. In your 40s, you should have 50 times. In your 50s, you should have 100 times that amount. And again, hopefully by the time you get into your 60s, if you've had kids, they're hopefully on their own. Maybe you've paid your mortgage off. You're hopefully in your highest earning years, which then obviously gives you your highest amount to save. And that's when we'd like to see you have 250 times that net amount. And if the net amount is only, let's say, $500 extra that you need above and beyond your Social Security and your pension, $500 times 250 is $125,000. So the spending is the most important factor in determining how much money you need to retire.
So if you're spending $5,000 a month and you are 45 years old, you only taking out your pension and Social Security, you only need 50 times more
Of the net amount, you're right.
Net amount. Okay.
Yeah, if you say, hey, we're only spending $4,000 per month and we're going to get $3,000 from Social Security and pension, and we're in our 40s, if you've saved $50,000, that's 50 times the $1,000 difference, you're actually doing pretty well. Keep going, but you're doing okay.
Keep going. How can younger listeners who may have started late, how can we catch up? You've met me, and I can safely say that we does not apply to me, but how can younger listeners, like my kids,
catch
up? Yeah,
anyone can. And the older you get, the more that it becomes, you get into panic mode about it, regardless of your income and your savings and your spending. So younger listeners, though, the quickest, easiest way to do this is to bump up your pre-tax retirement savings rate that you're having pulled out of your paycheck at work. Hopefully you have a 401k, a 403b, or a 457, or even a smaller employer's SEP or a simple plan. Just bump up the amount of money that's coming out of your paycheck every single 2 weeks. And you can do it for a week and try it. And if it doesn't work out, by the time the next paycheck comes around, you can always scale back a little bit. But by setting aside more money into a pre-tax plan like a 401k or 403b, it cuts your taxes now from anywhere from 10 to 30 cents for every dollar you put aside. You might get a match from the employer, but more importantly, it cuts your paycheck down a little bit. And that allows you the terrible situation of having to cut your spending down. But you will be surprised at how resourceful you can be with this small cut, trying to figure out how you can cut your spending down. If you can't cover it, you can try to spend less money, but then you can also try to pick up a side hustle. We've talked in the past about the number of young adults who are trying to pick up extra money just to make ends meet. Well, there's nothing wrong with picking up some extra money so that you can still live the life you want, but then retire comfortably on time.
And we're talking, you know, even $50 per paycheck is enough to make a difference, yes?
Yes, we're going to talk about that later on the show, but we have some examples of just a little bit of money can make a huge bit of difference if you're doing it over the longer term.
We are talking about how to achieve financial independence on this week's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. You know, it's Independence Day week, and we want people to be able to achieve financial independence. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email On Your Money at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bob from Greendale, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what is your question, Bob?
My question is about corporate bonds. We recently sold our house. Of course, I'm retired. We recently sold our house and have a substantial amount of money, several hundred thousand dollars. And for the sake of security in retirement, we'd like to invest it in corporate bonds. And we understand that corporate bonds interest rates should be increasing, and therefore I would like to know where I have a list of corporate bonds availability so that I could invest in corporate bonds, or a source of information to know what interest rate corporate bonds are paying.
Interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, Bob, good problem to have. What led you to corporate bonds in the first place?
What led me to corporate bonds is because we haven't invested enough in stocks that it's time to switch over to bonds. And besides, interest rates are increasing. I don't intend to buy them this week or next week. But if there's another interest increase in September, and there probably will be, interest rates should rise, and so should payment interest on corporate bonds.
Yeah, there's a couple issues I have with this. One is if you already have money in the stock market, lending money to corporations by buying their bonds is really kind of like having more money in the stock market, because your success is predicated solely on the ability of that corporation to do well and pay the bond off. And there's a huge swelling of corporate debt out there right now. Some of it is being used to open factories or buy competitors or what have you. A lot of it is being used just to buy back stock. And that's generally doesn't have an immediate payback for the corporation. It makes the stock price go up, but it doesn't. It's difficult to earn the return on that money. It's kind of like being a business and then buying part of your own business back for it with money that people are willing to lend you. So I would really stay away from corporate bonds based on what you've told me. I don't think they're safe, and I don't think they're secure. They can certainly be in a portfolio. They do pay a little bit more than safer investments, but I'd much rather, Bob, have you use certificates of deposit. You will find that the current rates are not that much lower than what similar, more risky corporate bonds pay right now. And the great thing about CDs is that they're FDIC insured. Most corporate bonds have no government guarantee to their backing for it. It's only the reliability of the corporation paying the loan back. And if you buy CDs at banks or credit unions directly, they usually only have a penalty for early withdrawal that's only 6 months to 12 months worth of interest. So if your scenario of rising interest rates takes place, if you buy CDs, with the CDs you've purchased elsewhere, you can redeem those and take the money across the street and get a higher yield. But the corporate bonds that you've purchased, whether interest rates rise or if the corporation's financial stability becomes more wobbly, those corporate bonds will decline in value. And you have no choice at that point to either other than sell them at a discount or wait and hope that they come back to the value by the time the bond matures at maturity, or They may never come back. Many corporate bonds have dwindled in money down to, you know, 60 or 70 cents on the dollar, and some have gone completely bankrupt, and the bondholders have gotten nothing back for it. So based on what little I can learn from you on the radio, I'd much rather have you go with certificates of deposit than corporate bonds.
We are talking about financial independence, and thank you, Bob, for that question. In honor of the Independence Day week we're celebrating here, 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley, what about those who are retired like Bob and who want to stay that way?
Yeah, we can still base this on spending, but you do it based on the amount of assets you have, kind of the reverse of the equation that we use when you're building up towards retirement. Take the total amount of your assets. This would be checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs, 401ks, IRAs, Roth IRAs, whatever you have. Add that up and then divide that by your life expectancy in months. And add that to what you're already getting in Social Security and pension, and that's how much you can spend in this particular month. And depending on how often you want to do this, you can do it every single month, and that should be able to tell you. So all you need to know are basically two factors. Add up what you have and divide it by the amount of months that you think you can live.
So this is why a possible correction in the financial markets might be scary, because that might mean you will have less to spend.
Exactly. That's a great point, because if you have $500,000 now and you divide that out, let's say you have 20 years to live and divide that by 240 months, that gives you $2,083 that you can spend in this month plus your Social Security and your pension. But if that money drops in half, that $2,000 a month goes down to $1,000 a month. So you're right. Preservation in retirement, especially if you've already kind of made it, is an important goal that a lot of retirees miss.
So it's hard for a lot of retirees to spend, since they're worried about running out of money. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, it's one of the curses of being very fortunate, being able to save money over the last several decades, and riding a huge stock market gain from 1983 at the Dow at 800 up to 25,000 or so that it hit earlier this year. But you're still worried about running out of money because of inflation and long-term care. And the perception of spending is that it keeps going up every single year due to inflation. In reality, and I knew this anecdotally from dealing with my clients, but I've also seen it done statistically through studies, is spending in retirement generally rises quite a bit in your 60s after you retire, because you're spending more on travel and you're doing things to your house that you've been kind of putting off while you were working. But then it starts to decline down in your 70s again, especially when adjusted for inflation. It really drops in your 70s because you just either don't have the need to do it, or physically you're not able to travel and do as much as you could in your 60s. And then it rises again, usually in your 80s, very briefly while you're getting more medical care and health care. And then in terms of long-term care, we all have stories of an aunt or an uncle or a parent who had dementia or Alzheimer's, terrible situation. They were in a facility for a long time. It drained all their savings. Mm. But the truth of the matter is that most people do not go to nursing homes for a very long time. Only about half of people end up in a nursing home. And when they do, the median stay is around 11 months or so. So that can usually be funded from savings. And especially if you're a single person or a surviving spouse, oftentimes what happens is, even for people who don't have a lot of money, once they leave their primary residence, they can sell that home and then use the proceeds to pay for long-term care.
We are talking about financial independence on today's On Your Money, and we're taking your phone calls, 800-642-1234. John from Madison, welcome to the program. John, are you there? Hello, John. Okay, so Kevin, John's question was that he's looking at very early retirement. Do the penalties count if you're in a position to retire early? I'm not really sure what that means.
Well, there's a 10% penalty if you pull money out of IRAs or 401ks, and to a lesser extent even Roth IRAs, if you're under the age of 59 and a half. And that's true when you just pull money out. And you can avoid the penalties but not the taxes on the money if you have a reason that can be things like paying for health insurance, or you have a financial emergency, you're covering higher education expenses. But there is a way that if you are at your same employer and you leave at 55, you can pull money out of that 401k, not the IRA if you roll it over, but just the 401k. And you can pull it out and not pay any 10% penalty on it whatsoever. So if you're thinking of retiring early, you probably want to leave at least some, and probably probably more of your money into your 401k plan so that it can be tapped without that 10% penalty for early withdrawal.
So I have a question. If you change jobs and you have a 401k at one job, can you roll that over into your new retirement at your new job?
Is this a question from Carrie in Madison?
I don't know.
Okay. Yes, you can actually do that. Most employer plans will allow you to take the money you've accumulated at your own plan, move it over with no taxes and usually no penalties or anything into the new plan. And that can be a good idea if you just want to have one account to manage rather than several. And also if the investment options in your new plan are more attractive than the ones in the old plan, especially if you've worked for a smaller company and you're moving to a bigger company, many times the larger the company is, the more low cost and more varied the investment options are, and that's a reason to move it into the new plan.
Okay, Carrie is taking notes right now.
She's one of my favorite listeners.
Yes, I think she is, actually. So, Owen in Wayawiga, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I don't have any type of retirement program offered through my employment, such as a 401k and whatnot. And the issue that I've been running into, I'm almost 40. I'll be 40 in November. I don't have any savings at all for my retirement. I'm in some debt with student loans and whatnot. But other than that, I don't have any long-term rolling credit card debt or anything. But I find that when I have a little bit of money, I end up spending it. And I don't make very much. My salary is pretty small. So I need to be kind of forced into a way of retirement savings through a weekly or monthly withdrawal out of my, automatic withdrawal out of my direct deposit that's going to help me to save the money I need to retire on. Is there a program out there for somebody that doesn't have a 401k offered through their work that could help me facilitate a little bit of a withdrawal monthly or weekly so I wouldn't be in kind to spend my money when I have it?
That's a great question, Owen.
Yeah, Ryan,
you're
right, Carrie. And Ryan, thank you so much for saying that, because, again, I'm so glad you are very self-aware of, and a lot of us struggle with this, whether it's food or alcohol or cigarettes or money, is by saying if I have it in my hand, I'm going to use it and I'm going to regret using it. So what can I do to put a little barrier up if I don't have this access to the plan at the employer? And what you can do is you can open up a Roth IRA, probably at your own bank or credit union, but for sure at a company like Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard. And you can oftentimes seed that with as little as a few hundred dollars to get it started. And then they'll have a mechanism in place where they'll automatically pull money from your checking account. They usually can't do it from your paycheck, but they can do it from your checking account every month, every 2 weeks. You can raise it, you can lower it, you can start it, you can stop it. But I'd start by just saying I'm going to have $100 every paycheck pulled out automatically from my checking account and slid over into this IRA. And it should go to an IRA if you're making more than $50,000 as a single person or more than $100,000 as a married couple filing jointly. If it's not, it should go to a Roth IRA, because you don't get a tax break on it, but you will get a little bit maybe in the savers credit, and then you can always pull the contributions to the Roth IRA back out whenever you want, and then pick an investment that is targeted towards your date of retirement. If you're 40 and you think you're going to retire in 20 or 25 years, you might pick what's known as a target retirement fund that has maybe a 2040 date to it, like the Vanguard 2040 fund. That has a mixture of stocks and bonds, mutual funds, and then it gradually grows more conservative as you get closer to that 2040 year. But good for you. Ryan, I'm just really impressed that you're so self-aware and that you know that you can do this and that you should do this. So good for you.
Thank you, Owen, for that. We are going to Richard from Manitowoc. Richard, welcome to the program.
Yes. Good morning, I have a simple question. When my dad was a boy, we had the gold standard. When I was a boy, we had the silver standard. I'm in my middle 80s right now. When you look at a dollar bill, it has no standard. Is that called inflation or...
Okay.
What do you call that?
Okay. That's a pretty complicated issue. But let's see what you can say here.
Well, we'll just go into the next hour, if that's okay. Could
yeah,
you
really.
Alert them down
right,
the line?
Right. That is an incredibly books have been written.
No,
about
but
it.
It's good to know because
this,
yeah, and it is good to know because a lot of us are only familiar with dollars, and we didn't know that at one point the currency was based on gold and it was based on silver, and some people feel more comfortable with that rather than just getting this piece of paper that's really an IOU from the government that says, hey, we're going to pay you, and so pass this off to somebody else, and like a game of musical chairs, if anybody ever comes back to us and claims this, we promise to back this up for it. But gold and silver aren't any better than that, because although there's a limited amount in theory of gold and silver, it's still a rock. It's a piece of metal. And it doesn't have any other intrinsic value. Sure, you can use it for jewelry or whatever, but it's no different than the faith and credit of the United States government in terms of saying, is somebody going to give me something for this? And so sometimes people feel better if they have gold because they think in the coming apocalypse they'll be able to cash in their Krugerrands or something and buy cans of soup and gas with it. But it's very difficult to manage an economy on a fixed amount of assets. And, you know, we're seeing this in a modern day version with Bitcoin, when you just create a currency and then you just try to say, well, this is a promise that somebody will take this from you for a good or service and it will always be there. People have already lost billions of dollars in Bitcoins that have gone belly up just in the past few months. And if it all comes down to faith, if you think that this piece of paper is going to allow you to pass it along to somebody else, you're going to take it in compensation for goods or services. But if you don't, you won't. And that's where the devaluation and inflation comes from.
We are talking about financial independence and taking your other questions on today's On Your Money. We're going to be back with Kevin McKinley in a moment. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. In honor of Independence Day week, Kevin McKinley is helping us figure out how to become financially independent. How are you doing on the path to financial independence? Are you keeping to your retirement goals? Have you had to go back to work? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. On Your Money at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've got a number of people who have called. Mary Ann from Madison, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Kevin, you are an amazing resource. And my question is, I'm in Protective Services, so I'll be retiring in a few months at 53. I've got a pretty good chunk in my deferred comp, and I will be getting a pension. My financial advisor has been talking about the long-term care insurance, so something that in the event that I were to become disabled, I could stay in my home. What are your thoughts about long-term care insurance?
Well, I think it's something that is a very natural attraction for a lot of people who've covered a lot of the basics for retirement planning, where they feel like I've got enough to retire, whether it's from savings or from pension. What's the next thing? And long-term care is definitely something to look at. Most financial advisors, the better ones, will at least bring it up. Some of them use that fear to try to sell you something that you may or may not need. And in your case, you know, you have a pension, and you're probably going to get Social Security too, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and you have a house?
I have a house, and it will be paid off probably within about 7 years of retirement. And I've also got my husband will still be employed, and he'll also have a pension. And I won't be pulling from my Social Security until in my 70s.
Okay. You can sure look at that. What you're probably going to find, though, when you go out to price these policies is that you're going to be spending at least a couple hundred dollars per month per person. And you're basically handing the money over to a company who is making a promise to you that if and when you need this care, that they will be able to pay for it. And a lot of companies are finding out due to mispricing their policies way back when or not correctly judging how long people would live, is that they have to raise up their premiums to people to keep the same coverage in force in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And not many people are getting into the long-term care insurance business. As a matter of fact, more are trying to get out of it. So it's harder and harder to find a policy. And at your very young age, I would be hesitant to start putting aside thousands and thousands of dollars every single year for something that you may not need. And even if you do need it, it's possible that the company could say to you at 83, hey, man, no offense, but we just ran out of money, so we really can't cover it for you. Or thanks for paying for all these years. Your premium used to be $200 a month. Now it's $400 per month. You can either scale back the coverage, cancel it, or start paying us a lot more money. And even then, we can't guarantee you at a juncture in the future that we will have enough. We'll certainly try, but a lot of things are beyond the long-term care insurance company's control. And so having a pension comes in means by definition you're alive, and if the pension and the Social Security are there, that can go to offset the cost of long-term care. So I would much rather have you I've known people who are smarter and richer than me who've dealt with this by saying we are going to take the amount that we would normally have to pay to the insurance company and we're going to bank that into a separate isolated account. It might be a bank account, it might be a mutual fund, whatever. And that's going to be our long-term care fund. And then we know that if we don't need long-term care, we're going to be able to have that. Or if we need it for a bigger emergency, like uncovered medical expenses, we can tap it for that rather than just handing it over to the long-term care insurance company.
Thank you, Marianne, for that. We've got a few calls here, 800-642-1234. Ryan from Madison, welcome to the program. Ryan, you there?
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be Brian, but I'm here.
Oh, Brian. Okay. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 37 years old. A couple of years ago, my wife and I bought a house, and we bought the house first and then sold our old house a couple months later. When we sold the house we used to live in, our plan was to put the equity into the new mortgage and reduce our monthly payment. But we didn't know until after the fact that we could not recast the mortgage. So we only would have been able to shorten the duration of the mortgage, which is fine too. But instead, we really wanted to lower our monthly payments. So we found a condo that we could pay cash for that already had a tenant and they had pretty low taxes. So we bought that and started getting that supplemental income right away to kind of offset the cost of the mortgage. Well, then the tenant left and it was vacant for a little while and we had to pay somebody to find us a new tenant, and it started to look like not so great of a deal anymore. So my wife and I are considering just selling it and putting it in back into the mortgage.
Okay, so we're kind of running out of time here, Brian. So Kevin, in real estate investments,
I wouldn't necessarily do that if you're thinking about selling it and paying off the mortgage with interest rates very low, unless you just have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars already set aside. Using that liquidity to get rid of the mortgage payment, unless you're, again, self-aware enough that you know that if you have the cash and the payment, that you will actually spend the cash in ways that you will regret. I'd still rather have you keep that money set aside, save more for retirement, save more for future health care costs by using a health savings account if you have that option instead. With interest rates very low on mortgages, with mortgages likely to be more difficult to get in the future and have higher interest rates, this mortgage that you currently have might be the best money you've ever borrowed, Brian. So I'd rather have you keep that money, save more for retirement, save it into Roth IRAs and HSAs instead. And over time, you'll probably equal the rate of return that you would have paid on the mortgage. And as we talked about last week, you may be able to deduct the interest on the mortgage as well. So unless you just have tons and tons of extra money, don't pay that mortgage off any faster than you have to.
We are talking about financial independence. And Kevin, you say the key to becoming and remaining financially independent is is our spending. You've said this a few times this morning. Any tips to help us curb our spending?
Yeah, it's a combination of long-term choices and daily choices, but cutting just a little bit from what's going out can make a huge difference. You mentioned before about trying to save just a few $100 per month. Let's say you look at your situation, you say, I'm going to go big on this, and I'm going to start trying to save $500 per month from my paycheck into a investment account or pre-tax retirement plan. If you save $500 per month and earn a hypothetical return of 6% per year, after 10 years of doing that, and trust me, these 10 years will go by much faster than any of us want them to, you're going to have $80,000, which is about the mean amount that people have saved for retirement round. If you do it for 20 years, you'll have $225,000. For 30 years, you'll have $500,000. And if you're a 22-year-old right now, and you're thinking about what to do with your money, I would beg you to start setting aside $500 per month. Because if you save $500 per month, that's $6,000 per year, and you earn 6% per year, hypothetically on that, after 40 years of saving, 22-year-old, you will have almost $1 million.
Okay, so let's start with those long-term choices.
Right, and those are living expenses. And as you're well aware, Carrie, you've made a move that costs different amounts of money to live in different places. But what we find is that the closer you live to an urban area right now, the more that the salaries generally go up, but the cost of living goes up higher. So try to live in the cheapest area that you possibly can. If you are struggling in terms of finding a house to afford, give up a few minutes of commute time or time to the supermarket or your kid's school so that you can save a lot of money on your house. It might add an extra 5 to 10 minutes to your trip to work or whatever, but it's worth it if you can get into a house that fits you. When you're looking at a house, smaller is always better, and especially if it's something that you can improve over time. When we bought our house way back when, I liked the fact that it had an unfinished basement because I wasn't paying for someone else's work for it. And if we needed to finish it down the road and were able to, we could do that at the time. If you're thinking about having a family or starting a family or having more kids, please do it. It will be the dumbest financial decision you ever make because kids cost on average about $250,000 from 0 to age 18, depending on your income and the situation. And there's also an intangible cost to that because you might have a job offer that gives you a higher wage someplace else, but you're hesitant to take it because you don't want to take the kids and put them in a different school district, or you don't want to upset their situation, so you have to pass on the job offer. And then finally, when it comes to education and paying for college, whether it's you or your own kids, understand that there is no direct correlation between paying a lot of money for education and getting a higher salary down the road. There's definitely a benefit to getting the education, but not paying more for it, like saying paying $60,000 or $70,000 a year for a small liberal arts school when you can go to a state school, get the same education for about a third as much or less. You'll still end up with the earnings increase of the education, but with hundreds of thousands of dollars in savings.
So get your bachelor's, but don't necessarily pay too much for it.
Exactly.
And the short-term choices.
Short-term choices are your daily and monthly spending. You should, first of all, know where your money goes by writing it down and then tracking it to make sure you're not getting out of hand. And by tracking it, you make sure that you know where everything is going, but also you see what you can cut. And if you find yourself that you say, I use my debit and my credit card all the time and I don't monitor my spending as well as I should, figure out what your acceptable expenses are, leave the debit and credit card at home, and take the amount out just in cash each week in the form of the allowance. So if you say, hey, $100 between gas, groceries, going out, $100 is what I should be spending every week, start every Monday morning with $100 in your pocket from the ATM and only go back to the ATM if you need it for an emergency.
Okay, Kevin, what is the website of the week?
Two good ways to track your spending are mint.com and ynab.com. You need a budget.com. I will have those websites at our website on yourmoney.com later on today.
And four words before we go, I can probably predict this.
Yeah, already. Only two shows in. Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joined us from the WPR studios in Eau Claire. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network on Tuesday mornings at 8 and then rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. The morning show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.